Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Election 2016 Autopsy Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week we take a deep dive into the American presidential election and try and find out just what the hell went wrong. Let's begin episode 358.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. I'm going to start this show by noting that Austria just elected an independent former Green leader as their president. One must wonder if Sanders was allowed to be the Democratic candidate, the U.S. may have swung to the left instead of to the dark side. So this week we're going to take a deep dive into how Trump won, how Clinton lost, and just who really gained from this presidential election. One of the tactics Trump used to win this election was to be as off-putting as he could be, lowering the bar, causing even more potential voters to turn off and tune out than usual. People's faith in politicians and politics was not high to begin with the result of appearing to be an even greater farce than first thought. Is Trump a genius for doing this? Who knows? The man has lived his life as he has his campaign, and in that sense, he is authentic. If also crass, boorish, and self-absorbed, as any narcissist is wont to be. He has stated, of those supporters who are devoted to him and his ideology, and to quote him, I could shoot someone and I wouldn't lose a single voter. Many commentators and pundits repeated the mantra that Trump had to broaden his appeal because his voter base, although loyal, were not of such numbers to carry the win and put him into the presidential office. Well, that would have been true if we were talking about a customary voter turnout. Fewer people showing up at the polls were not likely to affect his support. Remember, of the variety of reasons, which I shall get into later, his followers tend to be fanatical. No, the electorate to be put off by his antics were far more likely those who would have supported Clinton. And why were those in Trump's camp so impressed with him? Despite this nasty, his words not mine, off-putting campaign, well, as I've said, many people interpret his crass style as authentic. He repeatedly said that he's not a politician, that he would do things differently. And one way of proving that was, well, Trump was Trump, warts and all, if you will. His crude remarks, shooting from the hip, unrehearsed style, his penchant for lying whenever it seemed suitable for him. All of that was interpreted as him being real and not one of those fake politicians. That said, of course, we'll still never probably ever see his tax return. So maybe not all the warts, but enough that people thought that he would, as he put it, drain the swamp. Of course, that was the truth. Or perhaps not. How can we tell? A quick side note. The term draining the swamp is often applied to Washington because, well, lots of people believe Washington at one time was a swamp. And depending on your definition of swamp, it was built largely, especially the Capitol buildings, on reclaimed wetlands. So that's why they keep using the term draining the swamp, although of course now it has other implications. Getting back. Another technique that has made him seem real was his use of, quote, handlers. People in his campaign who were allowed every so often to rail him in. His famous teleprompter speech, where pundits were saying that the campaign team had finally gotten him under control and the campaign would begin to be more traditional. Only then, where Trump would do something like go on Twitter and have a major meltdown about Saturday Night Live, Fox News, CNN, New York Times, Obama, yada, 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 you name it. This, in my mind, signaled to his devoted supporters that he would be presidential when need be, but he would never be tamed. And that when needed to be, he'd kick ass and get things done. And that he would never be a regular politician. Another aspect of Trump's campaign was actively appealing to very specific groups. And this strategy worked for him in two ways. First, by addressing the very real concerns of a small but deeply troubled people, he turned them from people who liked him into fanatics who would support him to the point of voting for him even if he shot someone. Secondly, by playing up this "I play to win" talking point, he allowed these group of people to ignore what they didn't like about his campaign by rationalizing it by saying something like, "Oh, he's just saying that to get elected. When he's in power, he's not really going to be a bigot or sexist or what have you. No, when he's elected, he's going to work and solve my problem. He's going to make America great again." And I think this is one of the reasons Trump, knowingly or not, curried the favor of racists in America. I honestly do not think most Americans are overtly racist. Although there are some inadvertent racists, and more on that later, there's never been a lot of voters who would support the KKK or white power. But with the appearance of attracting such extremists, well, most people would not have believed that he meant that type of radical racism. And he did deny endorsement from the KKK, and I don't think he's a Klan member. But he is doing whatever it takes to beat that lying, cheating, blankety-blank Hillary Clinton. He's doing whatever he needs to win. He's a successful businessman who knows how to win, and he can't drain the swamp if he gets elected. Or I'm sure that's what goes through the mind of many of Trump's supporters. And no, the irony is not lost on me that we just talked about how Trump used authenticity as a selling point, and I just described how people justify his disingenuousness towards these fringe groups. But who were these major groups that seemed to break all expectations and vote Trump? One such group, the one I think shocked people the most, were those of the Rust Belt. What's the Rust Belt? It traverses the northeastern Great Lake and Midwest states. Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Iowa, plus or minus a few. These are areas that were, in the 50s and 60s, the heartland of industrial production. And the areas that were decimated when trade went global in industries due to a variety of economic factors, like the decline of U.S. coal and steel automation, while jobs moved south and overseas. Others were just plain eliminated by robots. Some cities and towns have adapted by focusing on services and high-tech industries. Others have not done so well, resulting in a rise of poverty and declining population. When Trump was talking about tearing up the TPP, NAFTA, imposing stiff tariffs on companies that exported jobs, starting a trade war with China, it was to these people that he was talking. Now, I'm not going into the fiction of what Trump promised. He was speaking to a very real, very important issue. Labor in the U.S. is suffering. A lot. The average wage in the U.S. has remained pretty much stagnant for the last several decades, which, when inflation is factored in, means a real loss in wealth and social status. In the good old days, and I use that term in reference to the white working class, foreshadowing here, folks, in those days, a worker at Ford could feed and shelter a family of four and live a very fine life as well. Now, today, a family of four requires that both parents work, and when the kids are old enough to work, they're expected to contribute to the family income, often because the quality of jobs have degraded both in wages and in hours available. Those parents need to work more than one job, and even then may fall into the spiral of debt just to keep the circus rolling. When there are parents, grandparents, looking at the latest generation and knowing that they will have to work harder to get less, well, you know something's wrong. And here comes Trump telling them that Mexico and China are stealing their jobs, that if only we stood up to these bullies, that, well, America would be great again. Of course, this glosses over the fact that manufacturing in the U.S. has never been greater. That the real loss in income is not due to outsourcing, although it has had its impact. The real culprit is the increase in automation coupled with greater income inequality. I.e., the CEO will receive greater compensation the more he shifts from people to machines. Where are the workers in all this? workers, it seems, to wield the least power in the scenario, and therefore are left in the cold, and somehow left out of the equation, conveniently ignored. And that flows well into the next talking point. Beyond the Rust Belt, people notice income inequality, and they wonder, why is there such a gap? There is a good reason for that, but Trump doesn't want to point to the fact that people like him leech off the backs of labor, or that the system is set up to profit the 1% at the expense of the rest of us. No, much easier to put the blame on foreign nations and those murdering, raping, illegal immigrants who are taking all those high-paying jobs that could go to decent, real Americans, if only real Americans were given the chance. And building on that last bit about illegal immigrants, it was assumed, at least by pundits and the Clinton campaign, that given the disparaging remarks that Trump had leveled at the illegal immigrants, they're rapists, they're murderers, etc., that this was Trump being racist. And it may be true, maybe not, because another unlikely group of American supporters surprising pollsters by voting Trump were legal immigrants. Trump picked up about 30% of the Latino vote compared to the 8% he got from the black voters. Why would they vote for a racist? Well, again, they excused or ignored. They rationalized the language in favor of what they thought was the message. Why should these people, the illegal immigrants, be given a pass when so many immigrants became Americans the legal way, played by the rules? Illegals should be penalized. If you were a legal immigrant who did everything expected, took years to earn your American citizenship, well, you may be sympathetic to someone who said cheaters should not be rewarded. Immigrant Trump supporters might also agree that illegals are, how shall we say, less than desirable, that they know that most Mexicans are hardworking, honest people, like they are. But if someone wants to cheat and enter the U.S. illegally, there must be a reason. So these illegals must be the bad ones, i.e. your rapists and murderers. One of the hallmarks of the Trump campaign, one of the reasons no one knows what will happen next, is, well, Trump's not a politician. He's never held a political or governmental office or post or anything like that before. On the one hand, many thought this would be a major handicap because, well, who hires someone to lead a company, or in this case a nation, who has never not only not done that job before, but has not done anything even remotely like it? Based on what Trump has said and promised, I'm not sure that he comprehends just what government is. Now, perhaps I'm being unkind to our southern neighbors, but American culture does seem to lead one to the possibility that Trump was, after all, the star of a popular TV show, The Apprentice, and those Yankees love their TV stars, Reagan, Schwarzenegger, Ventura, to name a few. I wonder, and I'm sure that there are future historians who will earn a PhD on the matter, as to what role Trump's TV show played in his election. I've talked earlier about the probable ignorance Trump has vis-a-vis the function of government. And he's not alone in that. I think it's likely a portion of some percent of people who saw the show and thought, yes, that is what a president of a nation must do. So Trump, he must be good for that job. And related to the myth of Trump, the business genius, he has never released his tax returns, so we have no idea how much money he really has. We do know that he's filed for bankruptcy many times. During the campaign, he was sued for false advertising related to Trump University. In fact, from what I've been able to discover, most of the value of Trump is in the name itself, that he does not have a vast real estate empire, but, and in this I will tip my hat to the man, what he's done is prospered on the Trump name, the Trump brand, as a kind of logo, gold seal, a symbol of success. His ability to merchandise the Trump name, for example, a skyscraper is built, and to extract optimal revenue for the space, the Trump brand is purchased. All the glitz and glitter that is the Donald is now attached to the building, and prospective tenants want to be part of it. Trump has nothing to do with the building beyond having his name on it, and is making tons of money in the process. That's why, with regards to the election, win, lose, or draw, Trump would have been ahead of the game because he knew he was going to make billions just by entering the race for president, simply because it would inflate the Trump brand. And now that he's actually won, Well, it's definitely going to pay off big. One of the fascinating features of this election is the number of people who thought Trump incompetent, untrustworthy, who just didn't like Trump, and yet voted for him anyway. Of those who said that Trump was untrustworthy, 20% voted for Trump anyway. Of those who said Trump was unqualified for president, another 20%, compared to the 4% who thought Clinton unqualified, or Mitt Romney, who only got 5% of those who didn't like him and yet still voted for him. Why? Well, as we've alluded to earlier with regards to the low voter turnout and the nasty nature of the campaign, there is a growing number of people in the U.S. who think the system is broken, that the U.S. needs to tear it all down and start from scratch, and they think that Trump will be such a bad president that he will screw the system so soundly, thus causing its total collapse, a second revolution, that the only way to fix American politics is to destroy it. And they might be right. Now, this is the first year that the Voter Rights Act has basically not been in effect. The Supreme Court ruling earlier this year stripped it of most of its power. Because of this, many people were worried that there'd be things like systematic voter suppression would occur. And how would this voter suppression happen? Well, you get new voter ID laws where people have to have, you know, photo IDs or the like in order to vote. And on the one hand, that seems to make some sense until you realize that a lot of people who are older, who are poor, don't have access to these kind of IDs. It's a natural way to help strengthen the Republican base. Another way they do this is they reduce the number of voting booths. It's quite famous now to see Americans lined up like around the block waiting to vote. And this happens because there's an active attempt to reduce the number of voting booths and thus the number of people who vote. But surprisingly, this seems to only happen in Democratic-leaning counties. There have also been reductions in voting times and voting days. Again, disproportionately affecting Democratic voters versus Republican voters. And one of the things that people were actually worried about was voter intimidation. As Trump rallied on about how the system was crooked and there was voter fraud and racism and Muslim terrorists, well, it seemed likely a lot of the not-so-nice people that support Trump would go out and make it hard for minorities to vote. But as it turned out, at least from my research, that didn't really happen. So at least one win of sorts. Another aspect of this election that aided Trump is the backlash effect. This movement had its roots in the Tea Party. That, as part of the critique of Trump supporters, was the emphasis, even if accurate in fact, that much of Trump's supporters were white and less educated people, with the term non-college educated being bantered around the most. To a great number of people, the implication was that these people were dumb, as in poorly educated, i.e. not college educated, that anyone who voted for Trump would have to be stupid. And to be fair, I'm likely one of those people who called Trump supporters stupid, but not for a lack of a degree. That wasn't what made you stupid, but voting for Trump, even if you had a PhD, would, in my opinion, have made you stupid. But a lot of people saw this labeling as condescending, as writing these people off, and strengthened their support for Trump. But of course, as skeptical thinkers know, this is actually an ad hominem attack, even if you meant it the way they took it. Attacking the person, not the argument of the point. And as I say, this has had a hardening effect. The more you talk down to people, the more determined they are to show you, as in this case, show up and vote for Trump. Another way this backlash effect was felt was in the success of the Black Lives Matter movement and in social equality in general. The whole Bernie movement. One term I heard post-election was whitelash. And I think we could assume that this only means that the racist won, that white America is racist. And sure, there is a portion of people who qualify, but not in the numbers that saw turnout for Trump. Trump won the white vote by wide margins, by double digits in all but white college-educated women. And for non-college white voters, he got twice as many votes, at least based on exit polling. And again, I don't think the majority of people were Klansmen. But this does beg the question, why such a racial divide? And to make this divide clearer, Clinton got 75% of the non-white vote, and I believe 90% of the black vote. Well, one group of people who may have been driven to vote for Trump were those people who felt maligned and confused by the Black Lives Matter movement. People who never experienced racism and were confident they themselves were not racist. Who don't think about police shootings. When they hear Black Lives Matter, they think, well, why shouldn't all lives matter? Couple this with a society that has a lot of implicit and institutional racism. This can be seen in crime statistics, income inequality. White folk who tend to be distracted by the harshness of real life, they hear more blacks are in prison, so they must commit more crime, so they must be more violent. They see the headlines, maybe the first and last paragraph for a few seconds on the 24-hour news cycle. They don't have time to think about it with any depth, and yet they still form their opinions. And I don't want to go too deep into the why. The what is important. If you come from a culture where implicit bias causes you to think that black people are more violent, and then you see them participating in Black Lives Matter, you see them riot, this solicits fear. Trump's rhetoric becomes more tenable. The idea that you, as a white person, need to defend your culture against them. In today's society, as working class Americans are driven further and further down the economic ladder, there must be someone to blame. No, not blame so much as see things differently from a different point of view. As an example, affirmative action. Efforts to right the wrongs of the past. Well, it may seem harsh. Why should you suffer for the ills of a previous generation? What do I mean? Well, objectively, if we accept that people of color were discriminated against in the past, to correct this historical wrong, we need to provide extra opportunities now, just to balance the racial scales, if you will. And that is great and laudable in theory. But in reality, in real life, I, as a white person, submit an application for a job. It's not a great job, but it's stable and will pay the bills. Then the job is awarded to someone less qualified. And the term less qualified can mean many things. And I'm sure discussions on qualification status would be endless and varied. But to you, they get the job because of some diversity criteria. As in stipulated that a police force should have the same percentage of people of color as in the community it serves. Again, objectively makes sense, but to me on a personal level, that's racism, reverse racism. I was denied a job I needed and for all intents and purposes qualified for, except in one area. One of us got the job and one of us lost the job because of the color of our skin. On one level, I'm losing out because I am no longer getting my white privilege. I, from my perspective, don't see it as privilege, but just as the way things are. History and sociology be damned. To me, here and now, I am losing out and they are winning. And literally at my expense. Don't get me wrong, I'm not agreeing with this commentary, but a great number of people, I'm sure, think about it in this way. Many people, white and those of color, are suffering from the oppressive capitalist system more than ever. And the system, this includes Trump, does nothing to alleviate this. But instead, this smoking anger is fanned into a bonfire of racism. Many people who are not racist see this race card as other. Those other, being black folk, take advantage of the government, are freeloading off the system at the expense of the white folk. And again, this isn't true. But this is how Trump has gotten people to think about it. And thus, white lash may not so much be a resurgence of racism, but another effort by the 1% to distract labor away from the true causes of economic inequality, capitalism, and distracting them with affirmative action as reverse racism. Now, one developing story is the influence Russian hackers have had on this election. Well, let's not put all the blame on Russia, but it seems undeniable that the hackers who were Russian, totally not under the influence of Putin, hacked the emails of the Democratic National Committee, the formal governing body of the U.S. Democratic Party. as well as the emails of John Podesta, an important Democratic strategist. That the aim of this hack was to influence the election is also undeniable, because it seems that although the RNC, their emails were hacked as well, but none of their emails were released to WikiLeaks, although I can assume that they may be used in other more nefarious ways in the future. Nonetheless, the direct effect the contents of some of these emails would have had on the campaign would be to shift the voting trend, as well as the knock-on effect of highlighting the dangers of Clinton using her own private email servers. There are many pundits now beginning to call this election a coup orchestrated by the Kremlin. So that's how Trump won. We're going to take a pause right now and go for a bit of a break. And when we come back, we're going to see how Clinton lost the election.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Like Star Trek.
Yeah, cool.
Awesome.
I love the Lord of the Rings. Great.
Great, yeah.
I'm into obscure 1950s atomic monster movies.
Okay. Sure.
I really enjoyed the Michael Bay Ninja Turtles.
We can work with that. Here at the UBC Sci-Fi and Fantasy Society, we accept everyone. We have weekly movies, game nights, and the largest non-academic library at UBC. Come by our club room, 3206D in the Nest. It's a great place to eat lunch, hang out,
and procrastinate.
Check out our Facebook group, UBC Sci-Fi and Fantasy Society, to find out what's going on.
You're listening to Radio Free Thinker on 11.9 FM CITR, your Russian hacker-free radio broadcast. And we're back. Okay, so those were some of the ways that Trump won. But another theme of this election was the fact that the only way for Trump to have won was for the Democratic nominee to have lost. We talked about the way Trump and the Republicans tried to reduce voter turnout. Well, Clinton had her own way of doing this. First, she was a grievously flawed candidate. Many people thought the choice was between an incompetent blowhard and a corrupt puppet. We'll explore more about Clinton's baggage, but I wonder what backroom deals were made to, well, crown Clinton. She had no serious competition from the Democratic Party. It is telling that the only person to truly challenge Clinton was not actually a Democrat. The party machinery did everything they could to derail the Democratic Socialist Independent candidate Bernie Sanders, and even then, he gave her a run for her money. If the party apparatus had been less biased, I'm sure Sanders would have won both the nomination and the presidency. Another way Clinton lost, but surely should have won, well, she was running against Donald Trump. I mean, really, who would vote for him? Well, the one thing he did bring to the table, if in an incoherent and fuzzy way, was a vision. He was going to, quote, make America great again. What did she offer in response? Stronger together. What the hell does that even mean? Sure, some focus group thought it was the opposite message of Trump's politics of division, but Trump delivered in full sentences and paragraph. Stronger together sounds something a Sunday school teacher would say. And according to Wikipedia, Clinton had four main slogans. Hillary for America was one. I'm with her was another. I mean, Snoresville. Compared to Trump's, albeit negative slogans such as drain the swamp and the real crowd pleaser, lock her up, the ever popular build the wall, and my faves, not to mention rhyming, you can't stump the Trump. So Trump delivered the reason for people to vote. Clinton just never could quite find the right message to land on, and as such, she just never got the excitement that she needed to bring out this election. In a year that was very much a no more of the same, being a career politician was a huge handicap. And you could see that in the Republican race, Trump beat out his competition almost in order of the more, quote, establishment they were. Ted Cruz, the last holdout, was himself a let's blow up Washington type, irrespective of the fact that he was also a career politician. And it was also quite evident relatively early on that one of the things that made Bernie Sanders a real threat to Clinton was the fact that he was outside regular politics. Yes, he was a career politician, but he was also a socialist, an independent, and he spoke truth to power. An attribute lost on Hillary, and one that could have turned the tables against Trump. But alas, no. One of the main issues Clinton missed was economic inequality. A misstep on an issue that was instrumental in the success of the Sanders campaign. Sanders was talking to the people in a language they understood, poverty, declining income, and a sense of loss of the American dream. She did try to pivot her message, but I don't think she really got it. I mean, she's been living in a Washington bubble for decades. She was one of the 1%, or at least 10%. I truly believe on this issue, she was unable to relate in any meaningful way, and thus was perceived as insincere and part of the corporate takeover of government. This could be seen, this lack of understanding of inequality, at least the economic variety, when brought to the fore by Sanders and Trump in the form of her speaking engagements with corporate America, and the fact she never released a transcript of what she said when she said, for example, gave a speech to Goldman Sachs, What about? We're likely never to know. But that just made things worse, because now we were left to fill in the blanks with the worst possible things we could imagine. The fact that she earned and raised a significant amount of money, hundreds of millions, with these speaking engagements, tended to give a rather good indication of the segment of society she cared about, irrespective of perhaps her personal feelings. I recall a line in which she stated, "But if everybody's watching, you know, all the backroom discussions and the details, you know, the people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need to have both a public and a private position." Well, that was a critical hit. And don't get me wrong, one of Clinton's problems is pragmatism. The reality of politics is to be, to a certain degree, duplicitous for the greater good. But when that becomes public, and to be fair, she did make the statement to the public when she met with the National Multi-Housing Council in 2013, but it resurfaced as part of the WikiLeaks email leak. And this, I think, had a fatal effect on her campaign. Another stance she took that was, as a queer politician, obvious, but in this year of bizarro land, very ill thought out, was her support of the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership, a very flawed trade agreement that Obama supported, corporate America supported, hell, even the Republicans supported. It was likely the only thing Obama could get past Congress. But of course, it was highly unpopular with the working class Americans, a surrender of democracy to corporocracy, and Clinton supported it. Until, thanks to a cold splash of water that was the Bernie campaign, caused her to flip-flop. But this only showed to some segment of the population that she was opportunistic and unreliable. But alas, not all flip-flops are the same. First, and I disagree with this sentiment, that flip-flop is a weakness of character. As a good skeptic, I'm quite willing to be a flip-flopper, with the caveat that said flip was based on increased or improved information or data. Thinking the sun revolved around the earth was logical until we accumulated enough evidence to the contrary. Then a rational individual would flip-flop about the earth-centered to sun-centered solar system. Sometimes a flip-flop is that 20/20 vision we always talk about in the rearview mirror. But it appears Clinton was changing strategy in order to garner votes. That she was not weighing the evidence. She was an old guard politician, and she figured she could swing more votes in her favor by giving lip service to the anti-TPP stance. People didn't trust her, and were not going to give her the opportunity to prove that they were right. Whereas Trump made no attempts to seem consistent, honestly. He lied and contradicted himself constantly. That made him seem fallible, more human. Every attempt by Clinton to shift message that she heard the people and was moved, every flip-flop just reinforced the narrative that she can't be trusted and that she's just another polished politician. Another important moment the Clinton campaign was her encounter with the Black Lives Matter organizers. She listened to them, politely, and did something rational, but something that cost her votes. She asked them for pragmatic ideas to improve their situation. I mean, it's a good question, but it missed the moment, the point. They did not want, at least at this point, practical action. They wanted to be recognized. They wanted their problems to be acknowledged. They did not want to be treated like some errant schoolchild. The tone was condescending. However genuine Clinton's opinion may be in regards to the plight of blacks in America, what she should have done was pull a Trump, be raw, emotional, and say, "I hear what you're saying. It's wrong, horrific." And then end on a note that, "When I'm elected, I'll fix it. Black men will no longer fear for their lives when they're pulled over by the police." That would have reached the Black Lives Matter people. That would have gave them a reason to come out and vote. Nothing more. She wanted an answer to a practical question, a beginning to a solution. What can we do really to make things better? When the real question was, acknowledge our plight and give us hope. Hope was an Obama thing. And it was never really in the Clinton playbook. I think another way that Clinton dropped the ball was an assumption of support. I mean, let's be fair. If you were a black voter, a Muslim voter, a woman, were you really going to vote for the man who said that your people are criminals, terrorists, that your private parts are fair game for the famous? No, as mentioned, Trump lost every demographic except white. And he even won the women's vote, except, of course, for those college-educated women. But what do they know? Trump was not going after the broader base. He focused on a very specific number of issues that motivated a very limited voter base. All Clinton needed to do was motivate everyone else to vote. And she failed in that. One of the reasons she failed was she believed, though they may not vote for her, they wouldn't vote for Trump. And about that, she was right. What she failed to account for is the fact that many of them just chose not to vote at all. Trump said, and I think mockingly, in his supposed outreach to the black community, vote for Trump. What have you got to lose? And I think that resonated with a lot of voters. Not that they would go out and support Trump, but they needed a reason to vote for Clinton, and she offered none. And I think it was worse than that. The Democrats assumed this community would come out to support Clinton because the alternative was worse. But they ignored the fact that most of those people's lives were not getting better under Obama. That sure, Trump was, well, Trump, but would things really be any better? Any different with Clinton? By assuming the vote, she gave them no reason to come out. She took them for granted. A lethal mistake for any politician to make. One of the consistent understandings on why Trump won was not that he won more votes than Mitt Romney. He didn't. But Clinton so underperformed Obama, she lost because she failed to motivate Obama's people. They felt voting in participating in this election was futile, so they chose to stay home. As I said, this was her election to lose, and lose it she did. I've alluded to the fact that, in one way, the Democratic nomination process this year was weird. With the exception of 2000, when Vice President Al Gore was more or less anointed as Democratic nominee, my research took me as far back as World War II, and it's revealed there's never been an uncontested Democratic nomination. Sans, of course, sitting presidents. And, of course, even then there were exceptions with Jimmy Carter, who was almost defeated by Ed Kennedy in 1980. In fact, the big story of 2016 was that the socialist named Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere to seriously challenge the Clinton nomination. And let us not forget that technically Sanders is not even a card-carrying Democrat. Now, this time it was as if said nomination was promised from on high. I am 100% sure that if this was a, quote, normal nomination contest, that people like Joe Biden, Jerry Brown, Russ Feingold, Elizabeth Warren, Al Franken, the list goes on, that if they had at all attempted to gain the nomination, that Clinton would have been eliminated before the first Super Tuesday. And we would not be facing a President Trump. I mean, she has a lot of baggage that dragged her down. She has her husband, who, among other things, was perhaps accurately compared to Trump with regards to his stance on women and taking advantage of them sexually. There is the whole super predator criminal laws that were enacted in the 90s and that she supported. And, of course, super predator in this case was code words for black people. She's a war hawk. She's many times supported any military movement. There's her private email, the speaking engagements, the conflicts of interest with the Clinton Foundation and foreign governments. And real or not, Benghazi. All these things would have eliminated her from the nomination process in any normal year. But this was not a normal year. And lastly, the nail in the coffin, if you will, was the WikiLeaks dump of the DNC and other emails. Now, I could do a whole show about the emails, how they showed that the Democratic Party was actively undermining the Sanders campaign, how it showed conflicts of interest between the aforementioned Clinton Foundation donors and those private speeches given to corporations, all of which undermined not only the idea that Clinton was honest, but it fed into the idea that she had a hidden agenda, one that was pro-corporation at the expense of the working class, and that she couldn't be trusted, and that the system was rigged. Of course, the biggest point of interest that arose out of the WikiLeaks email dump was the who and the why. I mentioned earlier that the U.S. intelligence agency knows, as much as they can, that this was done by Russian hackers. And that said, the dump was asymmetric, in that information that could hurt the Clinton campaign was released, while information that might have hurt the Trump was not. And it could have been bad, at least for the Republican Party, because we could all imagine what they were saying vis-a-vis the rise of the Trump. But they didn't get released to WikiLeaks. Again, I'm sure those are being held on for future favors. This may go down as the first American election where a foreign government not only hacked the U.S., but used the information to alter the outcome of a presidential election. And as a knock-on effect, the entire American democratic system. The U.S. democracy was hacked, and the Russians were the real ones who supplied the fix. It's my hope that both Republicans and Democrats will realize the real threat this is to American democracy, and together, in a bipartisan way, set up a firewall to prevent such manipulations of the American government in the future. So I'm going to take this moment to take another break. So we've covered how Trump won, how Clinton lost, but who else out there won in this election? Tune in after this break and find out.
Hi, everyone. We're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy.
And we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.
So if you want to get involved, email us at foodsociety@gmail.com or check up on our website at www.ams.ubc.ca/clubs/foodsociety, or you can even join our Facebook group.
Long before dinosaurs existed, sharks roamed the waters. Few other species on Earth inspire so much respect and fear.
Cruising underwater, and they have these huge muscles, cruising underwater.
And so they see this in kind of movies.
They can see you in pitch blackness. They hear your heart pounding inside your chest.
It's gonna do a lot of damage, even if it doesn't bite you.
They can sniff out a drop of blood. They can see you in pitch blackness.
Cruising underwater.
And so they see this in kind of movies.
It's a bite of the great white, bite of the great white.
Almost a death blow without even watching it.
It's a bite of the great white.
Taking it by surprise,
inflicting a massive fight.
Taking it by surprise,
inflicting a massive fight.
Great whites can sense blood in the water 3 miles away. And they don't keep us waiting long. And they don't keep us waiting long.
When the white sharks want something, they really go hard to get it.
They wanted us.
Nobody would get away.
Nobody would get away.
Cruising underwater.
And they have these huge muscles,
cruising underwater.
And so they see this in kind of movies.
Whoa, bam, they get it. It's a bite of the great white.
Almost a death blow without even watching it.
It's a bite of the great white. It's a bite of the great white.
Almost a death blow without even marching.
It's a bite of the great white.
We still have a lot to learn about these mysterious and misunderstood creatures. Scientists continue to unravel their secrets.
Nothing goes together better than live music and a beer. Or two. Or five. Wait a minute. An estimated 886,000 Canadians age 15 and older abused or were dependent on alcohol in 2012. 1 in 7 Canadians age 15 years and older experience verbal, emotional, and physical abuse as a result of another person's drinking. Make sure a fun night out doesn't ruin everyone else's, or your own. If you see yourself or someone you know slightly off key, help everyone out and step in. After all, you want to be able to remember the show tomorrow morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Thinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. Your source of motivation to be skeptical in every day and every way. And we're back. Okay, so beyond Trump, Who else won? Trump, as much of a buffoon as he is, did signal a major change not only in American but global politics. One of the biggest winners on the domestic front is the alt-right movement. What is the alt-right movement? Well, it's in a nutshell, it's a group of people with far-right ideologies who reject mainstream conservatism in the United States. Although the alt-right has no formal ideology, it includes catchphrases like white nationalism or supremacism, Islamophobia, anti-feminism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, ethno-nationalist, right-wing populism, nativism. You get the idea. It is the modern-day equivalent to the Nazi or fascist movements a century ago. The alt-right was a fundamental part of the Trump voter base, and they are expecting great things. One of their campaign slogans, a play off the official Trump slogan, was "Make America White Again." I do plan to do a segment on this movement in the new year, and now that Trump has made these people, quote, respectable, I hope to be able to report on them more accurately in the future. And also, as far as the big win goes, we'll see as Donald Trump fills out his cabinet as to what influence they will have. It is already quite troubling that Steve Bannon is a key aide in his government, Bannon being one of the leaders of the alt-right movement. That said, in my estimation, Russia appears to be the biggest winner internationally. Not only did Russia prove that it had the ability to manipulate a democratic election, we've already discussed who, thanks to Russian hackers, at the minimum did a data dump that aided Trump in his win. We also have to acknowledge that thanks to American reliance on electronic voting, especially in key swing states, it is at least possible that hacking by Russia was not limited to emails, that they may have actually changed the voter count on these poorly secured voting machines. But beyond the power Russia exerts vis-a-vis democracy hacking, Russia has become a bigger player on the international scene. First, and not to blame everything on Trump, with the apparent win of the Assad government in the Syrian civil war, Assad, who is greatly and I think unconscionably supported by Russia, support that was contrary and in opposition to the American position, showed both the incompetence of the U.S. foreign policy but a fundamental impotence of U.S. military might. Yes, the U.S. has the largest military in world history, but is also strong across the globe and lacks a fundamental mission. It is just kind of there, and that lack of purpose has shown up time and time again as an Achilles heel. An example of having the biggest fighting force is not necessarily equivalent to having the most powerful or effective one. Russia must feel mighty powerful these days. And what does that mean now? Well, I would think that the Baltic states would be feeling rather nervous right now. Russia has previously used cyber warfare to attack these nations. With large ethnic Russian minorities, coupled with a sense, from a Russian viewpoint, that they are part of historic Russia, well, who knows? And don't get me wrong, this does not necessarily mean that we will see a repeat of the Crimea, but that scenario has become much more likely, especially with Trump's comments about not supporting NATO countries he deems are not pulling their weight, coupled with Trump's comments that the U.S. should be less involved in global affairs. To expand on this note, other parts of the world may become areas of Russian expansion, such as eastern Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, no, not that one, the one by the Caspian Sea, Armenia. Putin must be like a crow searching around for little sparklies that it can pick up and add to its nest. And if you were enjoying a good night's sleep, let us remember that Russia recently deployed nuclear-capable missiles in Kilograd, a Russian enclave just a little north of Warsaw and within nuking distance of Berlin. Another winner on the geopolitical stage is, ironically enough, China. Yes, China has been the boogeyman of many of Trump's rants. China is taking away our jobs. China invented climate change to damage the American economy. China's not white. Okay, that last one's not real, but given Trump's rhetoric, there has to be some implied racial slur in there somewhere. But China's been looking for a way to become a global player, a pivotal nation, and Trump has played right into China's arms. So on one front, Trump is pulling back on American foreign commitments. That means that in areas like the South China Sea, an area China has consistently and aggressively tried to exert territorial control and political influence, well, it seems hard to see that President Trump would care if the Philippines or China had territorial claims to this or that part of the sea. If it's on American soil, why should he care? On a more global scale, as Trump seems to be a climate change denialist, the only one now on the global stage, well, that's bad for the globe in general. But as this is a real threat to the planet, and to be honest, civilization as we know it, it provides an opportunity for China to be the leader, to rally the rest of the world around it, and to do what needs to be done, reduce greenhouse gases, and to do so in spite of the efforts of the U.S. to increase them. This move will give China a moral authority that used to be American. America used to chastise China over human rights issue, but this moral about face will allow China to gain the high ground, and coupled with the likely collateral bonus that will also become a global superpower in green energy, well, as I said before, I wonder what it was like to see the Visigoths round the hills of Rome. We are likely seeing the slow but now inevitable decline of the U.S. World War II transformed Britain from a global superpower to a needy nation. It seems inevitable that Trump is the American version of this transformation. A less depressing winner in the decline of the American empire is Germany. Why, you might say? Well, again, as Trump pursues an American first policy, a retraction of U.S. influence around the globe, it provides a space for other nations to step up and provide leadership in its place. One of the goals, and I mean this in the most positive way, of Germany is to be readmitted to the human race. Germany has carried the guilt of the Nazi years for a better part of a century. Germany would like to be like any other nation, a leader. But because of its past sins, it can never overtly pursue this. But in the vacuum, that is likely a Trump world, Germany can finally exert the influence and leadership it has longed for without fears of being accused of empire building. This power vacuum, from a German perspective, is not so much a power vacuum, but a gust of global, or at least European, power. A gust made all the more powerful in the wake of Brexit. The stage has been set for Germany to become the de facto leader of Europe, a position that since the days of Bismarck has only been a dream. And to conclude this winners list, all this may not be a bad thing. Russia will be a stick in the eye of a positive outcome, but China, although ethically challenged, is likely to be more of a stabilizing force than the U.S. has been. And with time, its ethics may improve. Germany is likewise a better steward of the West than the U.S. Sure, it has its problems and its bias, but is also a better democracy than the U.S., and in my humble opinion, a more positive voice on the global stage. Let us not forget Angela Merkel's pledge, in the face of increasing xenophobia in Europe, to accept thousands of refugees in a time of need. Yes, political reality has meant a pullback from this stance, but it is nice to see that a nation has a knee-jerk reaction that is positive for a change, even if in the long run it's not as great as we had hoped. Okay, now I had planned to do a who lost and a what can we expect from a Trump presidency, but time does not permit, as well as the fact that a Trump cabinet is still a mystery that will unfold in the coming days. Although much of Trump's cabinet has been partially appointed, and that has been quite enlightening, the posts of Secretary of State and Secretary of the Interior have yet to be announced, and these are perhaps the most important and telling positions to be filled. So I shall cast that challenge to a future show. This is Don saying, oh my God, it's the end of the world as we know it. But even though, we should still keep our eyes open and minds on. Good luck, everyone.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free.